Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Scott Stokely, a disc golf legend and founder of Blue Power Disc Golf, and we're going to be discussing Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which won the 1967 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Scott, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great. This is kind of internal networking with the podcast because you were friends with Steve Holloway, who came on and discussed Ender's Game, and he had mentioned that there was somebody that he knew that was really excited about doing The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and it just happened. I had reached out to him during the Beaver State Fling and asked if he was going to be around because I thought I might head up there because that's in my neighborhood, just so I could meet him. And he said, no, sorry, I wasn't there, and then brought up the Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And I had told him that the person who had asked to discuss this book just had to back out. And so I needed somebody to cover it, and it worked out.
Hey, it works out for me because I like talking Moon is the Harsh Mistress, and I like talking about myself. So win-win.
Very nice. Yes. And I like that you're old school enough that you're like, I want to talk on the phone. And so we actually spoke on the phone. You're like, I really want to do this. And that was awesome. So,
yeah, super excited.
So why don't you tell my listeners something about yourself?
Oh, boy, the 50 Cent version. I have been old school professional disc golfer. I got, I don't know, 20 something world and national titles in disc golf and flying disc sports. I now have two things I do. Number one is I do email marketing. Mm-hmm. So if anyone has a business, they're welcome to contact me or organization. I'd love to talk to you about how we can help market your business. There's my business plug, the last one I'll give. My passion when I'm not working is I travel around and I run disc golf events for kids and adults with special needs. Mm-hmm. That's what Blue Power is. Blue, the color of autism awareness. These events started off as autism events focused all about inclusion. And then we very quickly realized that by narrowing our scope to autism, we were excluding other kids and adults with special needs. So sure. It became special needs. Still called Blue Power. Yeah. Steve Holloway was one of the big people who was behind helping manage this as I got it off the ground and helped for, oh God, a couple of years. So nice. Steve was a big part of it. But so now I try to introduce the sport of disc golf to kids and adults with special needs and their families. And that's what I do when I'm not working.
Awesome. And were you out in Oregon just recently?
No, I was not at the Beaver State Fling. Although that it was actually a big deal for me because I went out to that tournament. I took 13 years off from the sport from 2001 uh-huh. till 2014. And I came back and in 2015, I won the Masters division at the Beaver State Fling, which is a national tour event. So it was my biggest awesome. Win on my comeback. Yeah. So I got some great memories out there.
Yeah.
And by coincidence, I'm going to be doing a special needs Blue Power event in Newburgh, Oregon in a couple of weeks. So I'll be nice. Out that way again.
That's right. That's the one you're doing at Shampooey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, cool. Yeah. And if anybody disc golfers are listening, it's a traditional disc golf event. So you want to come out and play a normal, you know, PDGA tournament, please come out and play the PDGA event. However, in addition to that, as a side event, is a class for kids and adults with special needs on Saturday. And I run the event so I can go do my special needs work, but it's definitely just a great tournament as a standalone for sure.
Nice. Well, that sounds awesome. When's the date on that, by the way?
Oh, July, I'll just say 7th and 8th.
Okay.
And it's probably close. No, I think it's the 7th and 8th.
The nice thing about that, Scott, though, is that's after this episode will go up. So,
oh, then perfect.
That way the plug actually makes sense. So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of your history with science fiction and, you know, what your brand of nerdery.
Yeah, so I'm old. I'm 48. I work at a software company with a bunch of 25-year-olds, so I feel older than mm-hmm. I probably am. But my as a kid, I was very, very much into sci-fi and fantasy. By about age 25, I got into nonfiction. I've been locked into nonfiction ever since, mm-hmm. so I don't have a wealth of sci-fi knowledge. But what I typically did is I found an author I liked, and I read every single thing I could by that author. So mm-hmm. In fantasy, it was Piers Anthony and Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman, read everything they wrote. Stephen King, everybody, I read everything up till that date, till the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And in sci-fi, I read everything from everything Robert Heinlein wrote, everything John Varley wrote. But my knowledge is fairly limited outside of those authors I really like. So I think we were talking earlier, I think I've read less than 10 Hugo Award winning books.
Sure.
And only reason I'm close is because Heinlein wrote four of them.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you know, we don't have to talk about specific numbers there. And it's interesting too that, I mean, there's different ways to be kind of a fan, right? You can be a fan that's very deep in a few areas or very kind of shallow across a broader area. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to broaden because I'm kind of like you. Growing up and kind of when I got into reading, I would just find an author and read everything they had up to that point. And then I'd be like, okay, I guess I got to find another author until this person puts out a new book. And it was only kind of post-college that I started trying to actually check out new authors on a more regular basis. And that's kind of what this project is about as well, just to try and read other science fiction authors.
Well, and when I see something like this, it reminds me, like, I'm pretty sure I've never read Hugo or, you know, award-winning book that I haven't loved.
Right.
So the fact that I haven't read them, there's no real reason for it.
Right.
Other than just kind of being a crotchety old 20-year-old.
Right. So why don't we talk about this book in particular? Why this one?
Well, I guess it's my favorite book. If no other reason, then by default, one has to be your favorite.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it is the one that I would say I've probably bought 20 or 30 copies of it. Mm. When I've talked to someone who hasn't read it, I would run out to Barnes & Noble, or back in the old days, you'd run out to the mall, right, or something. But you haven't read this book, and I would have to get that book for them. It's one of those books, and maybe that's the philosophy part of it,
sure,
as much as just how much I enjoyed it. But when someone hadn't read it, I said, you have to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's how Steve, I mean, I was staying with Steve, and Steve mentioned that he hadn't read it. And 5 minutes later, I was on Amazon ordering it for him just because you have to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, kind of in our pre-recording chat, you were saying it's my Bible, and that's kind of what it sounds like, right? You want to tell him the good news of the moon is a harsh mistress.
Yeah, really. I want to spread the gospel of Heinlein.
Yes. And yeah, like I mentioned, you actually called me on the telephone like our heathen ancestors used to do, just to tell me how excited you were. And you were just like, I just want to make sure that you know I want to do this.
I wanted to make sure when I heard from Steve that you were looking for somebody, there's a window where you're trying to find somebody else. I needed to get to you first.
Right.
I work in sales, so that's that's why I'm good at sales.
Yes.
But yeah, it's like, you know, I was a kid bouncing off his seat with his hand in the air, just, you know, pick me.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that. Because for a lot of these books, because I started off having read 12, I think, of the books, and that was after kind of starting to try and pick up more of these books before starting the project. Most of these are first time reads for me. And so I need to have a guest who's passionate about it that can really talk about, you know, put its best foot forward,
sure,
essentially. So I'm very grateful to have you.
Yeah, I'm grateful to put my best foot forward.
Excellent. So in terms of kind of non-spoiler discussion of the book that we can do briefly before we get into more spoilers, can you give like a quick synopsis or elevator pitch for the book?
Yeah, sure. It's so the book takes place initially in the year 2074, I believe. Mm-hmm. It takes place on the moon. And at this point, it's been in the ballpark of 100 years that the moon had become a penal colony, which was, to a large extent, funded by the prisoners growing their own, growing products to ship back to Earth.
Right.
In this case, they were growing wheat. And I think there was maybe a little bit of lack of knowledge of what was on the moon at this point. It was written when it was written, but
sure,
it was believed, according to the book, that you could mine for ice and then manufacture oxygen and that we'd have the technology. Anyway, so the prisoners were basically forced labor and funding this entire penal project by using a giant catapult to ship huge canisters of wheat back to Earth. The problem arises when, you know, 100 years later, the majority of the prisoners there have either their sentence has expired and they're now free, or they were in many cases born on the moon. And now we're at a point when the book starts where the majority of people on the moon are free.
Right.
But because of, and this is the reality, physiological changes that take place inside the body, if you live in space or on some place with less gravity, you do not have the ability to go back to Earth. So it's really a life sentence when you're there, right, yet the people are free, but the only economy is that exists is to produce for the Lunar Authority, which is the governing body on Earth, that basically still capitalizes on the fact that you have slave labor that isn't going to even get food so much if they don't work. So they're free in name only.
Right.
but they want autonomy and they want rights, and there's talk of a revolution. And so the premise of the book is what happens when you're on this little rock circling the earth with not even a spaceship of your own,
right,
trying to get freedom. And a lot of the book is analogous of the American Revolution,
right?
You know, the greatest empire on earth, and here's this small little colony, but because of circumstance and geography, they were able to mount something that couldn't have happened before that moment in time. Right. So it's a little bit of that, and that's kind of the premise of the book, is what happens from that day forward.
Right. I think even the kind of, you know, year 74 to 76, you know, kind of reminds you of the American Revolution times.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and then the running theme of the book, the philosophical part, and I hate to even call it that because I don't want to deter anybody from reading a really fun, exciting, great story book, but the libertarian philosophy is, a lot of it comes from Thomas Jefferson, and who Heinlein was a very big fan of. Maybe not how it wound up, but the principles set forth at that time. So yeah, everything about it just kind of laid that out for, I almost said the word parody. That sounds silly, but an analogy, metaphor, some fancy word that says it was similar.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing, the crucial factor, right, in their rebellion even being feasible is the fact that they have Mike.
Correct.
Who is an AI, who, well, essentially like a bunch of computers that are on the moon to help with administrative tasks and that kind of stuff, which become sentient, become aware.
Yeah.
And is, you know, willing to get up to some mischief.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, some of the ideas that are introduced, which is so interesting. Like one of the things I did enjoy about sci-fi books, is I liked reading older ones. So even though I was reading books in the 80s and 90s, I liked reading sci-fi books from the 30s and 40s because I love to see what they said. You know, we would have flying cars by 1980, right, in the old books. And most of the science fiction authors that I'd read would overestimate where we had gotten to.
So.
And Heinlein completely underestimated and almost like everything that's revolutionary in the year 2074, we've actually done already,
yes,
for the most part, and better.
Yep.
So the idea of a sentient computer, well, that computer also was the size of a warehouse if you were to put all the components, right, together. But the idea was, yeah, you plug enough things into a computer, then you have as many connections as a human brain. And I believe there were at one point about 50% more connections in this computer than in a human brain when Mike woke,
right,
up.
Yeah, it's interesting. So kind of by way of overall thoughts, I was kind of going into this book thinking it's going to be hard science fiction and really dwell on, you know, the nuts and bolts of how the computer became aware and other, you know, the ins and outs of living on Luna, right, and how all that works. And there's a little bit of that, but it's definitely not something I would categorize as hard science fiction. If anything, it dwells more on the political and philosophical side.
Yeah, it absolutely could have taken place on an island.
Yeah,
in modern day. You know, it's more about that. Like the science fiction part was just a backdrop for the story.
Yeah.
Although there's certainly key elements that were required to drive a story, but it's not a book where you just go, wow, so technology can do this. Wow, they have devices to do that. Like some of the, I think that's what you're referring to, where you're wowed by the concepts.
Yes.
It was pretty simple.
So when did you first encounter this one?
My friend Rick Schaefer gave it to me when he was one of my Frisbee mentors growing up. And he was actually one of the project engineers at NASA. And so I grew up with him as a big father figure in my life. And he turned me on to all sorts of science fiction. And this was his favorite book.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. And that kind of paid it forward to become yours.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
To the extent that one book can be a favorite, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like from you, in terms of overall thoughts, you're like, absolutely, this is great. You must read it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, as a person that libertarian-esque,
right,
although I actually use the term rational anarchist from this book. And then when someone asks me what that means, I say libertarian. But I think that's where those ideas were planted. Like, I wasn't convinced to think this way because an author I liked it, but I think that most people who are libertarian think the philosophy speaks for itself. It's logical. And once it's presented to you in a logical way, it's easy to follow along with that belief system. You don't have to be convinced.
Right.
It's logical. It's rational. That's the rational part of rational anarchy. So that was probably my first introduction to it.
Cool. So I will say, by way of, it's not really a warning. It's just something that someone might want to be aware of before coming into this, is it's written in first person from Manny's perspective. And he speaks kind of the, what do they call it? The loony language, right?
Yeah.
Which is sort of a hybridized English and Russian and Australian. And so it makes it, I won't say hard to read, but it was definitely an adjustment for me to kind of get used to seeing so little use of things like articles like these and
yeah.
us. And I feel like there are a couple of places where I had to reread a sentence just because of that. And so that made it a little difficult in places, but the story to me moved along well enough that I didn't really mind.
Yeah. Well, the thing I liked about it is that kind of set you in a different world.
Yes.
Because when they have their own slang, it just kind of reminds you that it's somewhere else. I liked it. I didn't find that part challenging, and I don't read heavy stuff. So for me to not be challenging is probably not too bad. I tried reading Finnegan's Way. I forget it. not a chance. So, yeah, but I always thought that kind of set the tone that it is a different place. I kind of enjoyed that. And it's also kind of like accents. Like once I got into it a little bit, it kind of disappears.
Yeah, it does. And there were a few times I was trying to read some of it aloud, and you can't help but like put on your worst bad Russian accent when you do it.
Oh gosh. So. With my girlfriend, I love the audiobook of this. When I say read it, I've read it half the time, listen to the audiobook half the time. I go on long drives touring and stuff. So I listen to the book and we had a vacation we took where one of our things was I brought this book along. She had never read it. And I'm just going to read this book to her on vacation. And I realized 20 or 30 pages in that it was so much poorer me reading it than the audio version, because the audio version is so good.
Yeah. It gets exhausting trying to maintain an accent.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the audio version is that I've heard some audio versions of books where it was clearly obvious the person had never read or internalized the book.
Yeah.
And that they're reading the words and maybe they're taking on the emotion of what that sentence, you know, would sound like, but the character wouldn't sound like that. They have no understanding of the character they're reading. And I don't even know who it was, but the person that read this book, I swear he read the book 10 times before he did the audio version, because I feel like he nailed it across the board. So, yeah, this is one of those ones where if you want to listen to the audio version, I would suggest by all means, if you like audio better, go for it.
Yeah, I did listen to the audio version of it that I got from my library, and it was a good production. The guy did a good job with character differentiation.
Yeah,
absolutely. Not everybody talks that way, right? Like Prof, who's another one of the characters. This is a very erudite guy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have that kind of loony patois or whatever that they have.
Yeah.
So then kind of moving along a little bit, if you were going to recommend this novel to someone, could you recommend it on the basis of any other works, either, you know, television, movies, books? What do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I would recommend this book like I would recommend any book, which is a lot of really awesome people think this book is really awesome. Mm-hmm. And so dive into it for 20 pages. And if it doesn't catch you, you know, it's Pascal's wager, right? If it doesn't catch you, you've lost 10 minutes. If it does catch you, you've gained something that you'll appreciate for life. So it's worth the gamble. There's so much to gain, so little to lose by trying it. By the way, that's one of my software sales techniques. I don't tell people that's what I'm doing to them, but that's the logic of why you should.
I thought you were just staying consistent with your Gospel of Heinlein thing, because Pascal's wager is usually
a religious,
in the terms of religious faith. So. Which I am a Christian, so I understand.
Oh, yeah, I am not, and I don't use it in that tense, but I use that philosophy for a lot of logical things.
Sure. So for me, just kind of looking at it, like in general terms, if you like a little bit of political philosophy with your science fiction, then you're definitely going to get some here. It's consistent with other Heinlein that I've read. And I like this one. It just kind of makes you think about the purpose of government. And so that's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you know, it's got Mike, a very solid AI character. So if you're into, like, if you've ever read any of like Asimov's iRobot, you know, those kind of stories, I think there's some bits in here, particularly there's a story called The Inevitable Conflict, which kind of deals with, what would happen if there was an AI that was in charge of production and goods and that kind of stuff in a society. And there's a little bit of that here, where it does make you wonder at some point in this book. Oh, I better hold that one for spoilers.
Yeah. Okay.
and the other thing, just in terms of like, fans of this other work might appreciate this. Have you ever seen The Expanse?
I have not.
Okay. It's a series of books and now it's a television show, but it reminds me a little bit of this, where there's a culture out in the belt, you know, and there's a culture on Mars and Earth, and they, you know, they come into conflict with each other because everybody thinks they're better than everybody else, which is, it's the human thing to do, right? But then even in the belters, they have their own kind of language that is hard to understand from the people from Earth or Mars. So it just reminded me a little bit of the loonies versus the people from Earth.
Well, the thing that Heinlein explores, which is so interesting, is it is a unique society. It's a prison colony, but it's not a prison where you're governed by cell doors and wardens. So it is effectively a free anarchist society. And so he theorizes to what would happen in this environment. You know, some of the unique things are in the early days of the penal colony, it was 10 to 1 men to women.
Right.
So he theorizes what would happen in that case. I don't necessarily agree with, but it's all subjective, right?
Sure.
Like in his viewpoint, he views things unfolding a certain way as how people would get along in this society, what power or lack thereof women would have in a society where they're outnumbered 10 to 1. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the, all of Heinlein's female characters are extremely unique.
I do want to talk about gender politics.
Because
I can see kind of two sides to it, but I think it's time to get into spoilers.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so why don't we just jump off right there? Because I really thought that was interesting when he talked about the male to female ratio and how women had a lot of power because, you know, a man couldn't just go and grab a woman and say, you're mine, right? Because the other guys would also object to that. And as he said, airlock is only so far away.
Correct.
And so it's kind of self-policing where we have women here and we have to, you know, they're a precious commodity in a way, which sounds kind of insulting.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm not articulating it very well, but maybe you can pick up.
Sure. On. Well, his belief – well, so let me kind of back up to a generalization, and this is just going to be my philosophy of Heinlein, but mm-hmm. one of the things that people have found in more recent times that they felt they didn't like or at least controversial about Heinlein's books is his portrayal of female characters, which are pretty universal across most of his books. Mm-hmm. And the way that I think most people view it, although like I said, it's controversial, is that at the time he was writing the books, I mean, he came from a different era.
Yes.
You know, he came from an era where women were housewives. Women were responsible for cooking and cleaning and making babies. They had no power in society. They were barely able to vote. But, you know, if they did, right. It was probably what their husband told them to. I mean, like, it was just a different time. And for that time, Heinlein's female characters were strong.
Yes.
And they were leaders. And they were intelligent and rational and not just equal, but in some ways superior to men. Mm-hmm. And it's clear from his writings that he viewed women as very strong individuals, which was way outside of the box for that time that he was writing it. Mm-hmm. Where it gets controversial is that even though his characters were so far ahead of the time at the time he wrote them, in hindsight, you look back, there's still some weakness there.
Yes.
That, you know, that we can view. And it's funny because I think about this when I think about my mom who passed a couple years ago at 83 years old. And she grew up at a time where racism was far more accepted than today, obviously.
Yeah.
She grew up in an era, shared some of those views, but over her life realized those were nonsense.
Right.
And then as a 75 and 80 year old had completely abandoned the idea of like racist ideas. But would still say racist things,
right?
Because she was still, but her views were so progressive for how she was raised. Like
yeah.
her parents probably would have beaten her for some of these thoughts, but they still came across, you just cringe because she didn't see how those were racist, right?
Yeah.
But there was nothing in her heart that was bad. So I think I feel the same way about Heinlein, which is he was clearly trying to portray women as strong, powerful leaders. But every woman in every Heinlein book, at the end of the day, just wants a good husband and to make babies.
Sure.
And but in that in his world, that's what women did. But he didn't pigeonhole them to that. So I always admired him for that. And I just kind of cringe with a modern eye at some of those, you know, like you could pat a woman on the butt and she would just giggle. It was that.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
That's the thing I want to talk about was Wyo, who's this wonderful character in the book. You know, every time she walks into a room, she pauses and poses and the guys always look her up and down and whistle.
Yes.
And I'm kind of like, that's okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. No.
Exactly. But at the time the book was written, you know, she was one of the three primary characters that led this revolution against Earth that everybody loved. So he like the fact that he cast a woman in that role was so good.
Well, even I mean, you know, Manny, the protagonist, is not the instigator of the whole rebellion thing, right? He kind of gets swept into it, and Wyo is one of the people who's really leading that. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I always thought that was an interesting thing about Manny was that he wasn't. Yeah, he wasn't. There was nothing exceptional about him,
right? Other than the arm.
other than the fact that his arm, but that was only exceptional in that it got him work,
right?
But he was just a someone who was just cast into a situation and then had to do what he when he had that knowledge of. What was happening, you know, and we're spoiling is that they're come to realize that resources are going to be running out. If things don't change, it's going to be an environmental disaster and lots of people are going to die. And therefore you have a family, you have, you know, you have to do these things because you're going to sit back and watch your family and your world collapse.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to do any of it. He just wanted to do his job and hang out with the kids.
Yeah. But on the other hand, then he it's his particular knowledge and knowledge in particular of Mycroft that kind of allows the revolution to even exist. And I do like kind of going back to that, you know, how strong are the women characters here. I like the fact that the first not stupid that Manny introduces to Mike is Wyo.
Yeah.
I just thought that was cool because he had made a blanket statement. Mycroft had Mike. I keep saying Mike or Mycroft, just in case anybody hasn't read it. You decided to listen to the spoilers anyway.
Right,
Mike for short.
Well, that's what. Yeah, that, I mean, that's one of the interesting things too is that you know he and there are you know there's a lot of cultures that do feel this way is that Heinlein absolutely respected the home belongs to the woman. Mm-hmm. She's the boss. But that wasn't, again, in 2018, that's almost a derogatory way of viewing women. Like, well, yeah, right. She manages the house while the husband goes. Like, that's viewed as sexist.
Yeah.
But his view wasn't. His view was simply the home is the most important place in the world, far more important than your job or your friends or anything else. And the woman runs the home. Therefore, she is the leader of the family. Right. It's again, we just cringe through modern eyes, you know, but like he doesn't do any of this without, you know. You know, he has his head wife because there's multiple wives and it's a polyandrous society. And so the family has multiple husbands and wives. And so, by the way, this is one of the ways Heinlein suggested we would deal with the ratio of men to women is simply that most women would have multiple husbands.
Yeah, that was interesting, that whole concept of line marriage, which they do go into some explanation of. But then there's also mentions of clan marriage, which is something different that we don't get much about. But yeah, that was an interesting little science fiction concept.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is they almost run the family like a business.
Yes.
Very much. Where everybody's a board member and you vote, you know, there's several wives and more husbands than wives and you vote people in and you become a part of this is a business. This is how, well, there's no banks on the moon. So this is how you protect your financial assets. This is how you protect, you know, you have people that will protect you. And that goes back in society.
Yeah.
I mean, to lots of societies that your clan is your thing. So, you know, but the idea of marriage, well, and then Heinlein, this is one of the things he does in a lot of his books. When he goes into the future, he throws away a lot of the preconceived ideas of how things should be. So the idea of polyamory, which by the way was a part of his personal life from everything I've read, is that that is something that he believed we would evolve into. So yeah, and by the way, I've even heard that Virginia, his wife, who actually lived in Colorado Springs, not too far from where I am, I've read people that say if you met Virginia, you would understand the female characters of his books, because Virginia is Wayo. Virginia is, I forget her name from Stranger in a Strange Land, but his wife was in all of his, or, you know, most of his books.
Yeah, I think I've heard that about him. I actually did for my other podcast, I did an interview with Keith Cotto of the Heinlein Society.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. And I think he mentioned something about that, but it was a couple of years ago. So my memories are a little foggy. So at this point, you know, with the spoiler discussion, just anything that you want to talk about, anything you like about this book, anything you want to bring up, just fire away. I have a few things written down, but I'm counting on you.
You're counting on me. I would easier segue from what's written down. But so one of the biggest concepts of the book is it's libertarianism, yes. But it's the concept that, you know, Heinlein calls rational anarchy. And the it comes from the Professor Bernardo de la Paz,
right,
who was one of the three human protagonists of the book. And I've always, by the way, believed that Heinlein has injected himself into most of his books. So in Strange Land, he was Jubal Harshaw. He was also Lazarus Long. He was Professor de la Paz. And he creates a character that gives himself an opportunity to share his philosophical views through the same mouthpiece. So Prof, as they call him, is Heinlein, to the best of my knowledge. And he
makes sense.
Yeah, and he talks about the concept of rational anarchy. And he describes it – well, the way he basically – I'm not going to use his words, because I actually think that his description of rational anarchy aren't as accurate as what the entire book says rational anarchy is. But the basic concept is and again, it's kind of libertarian, but the word rational is what I've always keyed into, what I liked. So the idea is that Prof basically follows his own rules. He doesn't require government. He doesn't require society. He has his own morals. You know, he's not going to harm you because he feels it's wrong, not because some book says not to. If he borrows money, he's going to pay it back because he feels that's the right thing to do. He also is fully comfortable to pay for what he uses. And then if he doesn't have the money, not pay for what he doesn't use. That's a kind of a very libertarian view.
Yeah.
The idea of sometimes libertarianism falling short is projecting that view will work for everybody. Like, for instance, we don't need a government to have a fire department. Everybody can simply pay $12 a month to the fire department. Well, that falls short when people – well, at least, you know, according to my belief, is it falls short when there are people that don't have $12 a month, but we want them to house not to burn down, right? So the first part is the anarchy part. We don't need rules or he doesn't need rules or government. The rational part of rational anarchy is the accepting that other people do. And not that he projects that other people need to have his rules, because he doesn't believe other people, but he believes that as a group, as a society, certain rules allow things to function better. And I always liked that, because you know, I personally have grown up with beliefs such as, you know, I'm not a big fan of the police and the system and the prisons for profit and punishing people for victimless crimes and violating personal for all these things. So I don't like the police, while simultaneously I'm rational enough to believe that we would be worse off without them. So the rational part of that allows me to kind of back off from how I think it should be and maybe see it more how it is. And I always like that, you know, again, it's simply the word rational in there kind of forces you to check those viewpoints that maybe aren't practical.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of the intersection of pragmatism and philosophy, right? Because some people would look at what you just said and say, well, this is an inconsistent guy. You know, this is a hypocrite. But I think I like the way you put it, that that's just me having my kind of core belief there, but also thinking about it in terms of the implications.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. Can you still hear me?
I can still hear you, but it sounds like your microphone changed.
Yeah, I think my headset died, but if you can hear me, I can continue.
Okay. Yeah, we'll go ahead and keep going. So just for anybody listening, it sounds like Scott's headset died. So.
Yeah, it's because I'm too old to use things that are wireless. Okay. I apologize. I cut out for a second there with what you're saying, but you're saying it sounds like it's contradictory.
Right.
Well, and it's really funny because at a part of the book, Wayo even says to the prof, she says, well, wait a second, you're just being a hypocrite, trying to make a point, at which point he says – never said I wasn't. So, you know, it's the recognizing of one's hypocrisy. But I don't think it's hypocritical.
No, I don't either.
I think that like a traditional, another one that comes up all the time is, I think that you can really believe in a traditional hippie philosophy. Everybody's sharing work and we don't need money. We're going to share and it's going to be equal, while simultaneously saying, well, it won't work because not everybody is willing to work as hard as everybody else. And not everybody's willing to share. The philosophy, the theory's good, but the practical sense, it doesn't necessarily work. At least I don't feel it does.
Yeah. And it's interesting that to read kind of some of the little bits of philosophy that you get from Prof that are very likely, like you said, author proxy. I wrote down this quote here that he says, "There is no worse tyranny than to force a man to pay for what he does not want merely because you think it would be good for him." And it's a bit of hyperbole there, you know, a little bit of exaggeration. But on the other hand, it does make you think about, you know, raising taxes to do this thing that somebody might want to do on their own or they might not.
I mean, that is the challenge of government. But when you live in a representative government, you are deciding that those people are going to make those decisions of what they think is best for you. And these are all in theory, minus the corruption and the nonsense, but the idea of it. And that's actually what's really interesting, because he does take rational anarchy. And again, we're spoiling, when left to their own devices, people tended to feel that the representative government, you know, was what they felt was best or they agreed to because they were told was best because they're followers or whatever, for whatever reason. But the idea was it never was going to become as libertarian as he thought. But again, this is also a parody of Thomas Jefferson maybe having more libertarian views than actually manifested themselves, right?
Sure. Yeah. So we're kind of dwelling on the philosophy parts and not talking about the adventure portion of it, right?
Okay,
which is about how the revolution transpires. And we don't have to, you know, I never do like a full plot walkthrough of a book, but I didn't want to, you know, finish up without at least talking about how exciting it is at points when they, you know, they basically put out their Declaration of Independence, and then it goes kind of sideways a little bit, but they're ready for it, and it's entertaining reading.
One thing I like that I really like about this book, and this is how I feel about any book or movie, fantasy, sci-fi, I've always felt like I could accept any unreal premise to start the book, but once you set that premise, let's stay as realistic as possible within that premise. I mean, if you say someone can fly and has superpowers, I accept that premise, but then let's make it realistic with that premise, right? I just repeated myself there for no reason. But what I liked about this is that as impossible as a revolution from the moon sounds, when you look at the components that were in place, a self-aware computer that could control at least everything that happens on the moon, when you had a system of catapults that could launch grain, big old canisters of grain, but also rocks
to
Earth. You know, when you have that in place, when you have the premise of they don't have the technology on Earth to spot where a new catapult would be built, right?
It's an
unreal premise, but that the premise was they wouldn't see a catapult being built. So I accept the fact that how they hit the catapult, you know, many years later, it was still the most highly protected secret on Luna, which is where the catapult was that shipped all the grain back to Earth, even though you see it with binoculars. But
sure.
But once they laid that out, I felt it was very plausible how it went down. Like none of it seemed outrageous.
Sure. Yeah. All you need is a super, super smart AI.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, I like the politics of basically, it's not that Earth can't win. It's that how much is it going to cost them? How much political favor will they lose? Because people are starting to side with the people on Earth. Like, it's really a really sophisticated way of saying we're going to change the will to fight against us. And then, but still fight when we have to. But clearly, there was never a thought that the Earth couldn't win if it wanted to.
Right. And I think it's interesting too, the kind of natural advantages that the people on the moon have for being acclimated to it and, you know, being ready with their pressure suits and just being accustomed to the way the gravity works. And that would be a huge advantage to a defending army.
Absolutely. And also the idea that the people on the moon were extremely tough because, you know, I think they said that at one point, 50% of the people that came to the moon were dead within a year because if you weren't tough, you just simply didn't make it.
Right. that's where you get into the title, right? Where it's kind of taken from a quote in the book that says Luna herself is a stern schoolmistress.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think it's interesting that it's not quite the title.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I can't even like put into words like how much of the story was. It was just good storytelling. It was, yeah. And that's what Heinlein was a master at. He told stories that flowed, that were interesting, that were plausible, that were intriguing, with characters that were interesting and different and flawed.
Yeah.
But it worked. And then the dynamics of all the other people that came into play, like I thought Stu LaHoy was fascinating, because at some point you needed somebody with some power on Earth that could have some influence over the politics down there. Well,
right.
You know, the way that they managed to recruit him was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple things that I wrote down kind of as topics to talk about that I wasn't sure, you know, I can kind of go one way or on the other.
Yeah, sure.
Where like we've talked about gender politics, but there's also, it's certainly some of the language used here is not what we would call politically correct today. Right. Because there's ethnic identifiers like Afro and Brownie and Chinee, which sound like they're slurs more or less, but really it's just the population of the moon in this book is quite ethnically diverse, and even like the main character is mixed race, right? And so it's like, on the one hand it looks kind of cringy, on the other hand you're like, yeah, but I mean, they don't present that any racial group here is inferior in any way. These are loonies that are all working together.
Yeah.
So
it was still reminiscent of my mom. Like, I think they said,
yeah,
he said something along the lines of, if you put two Chinese people in a well together, they'll figure out how to get rich selling things to each other. And then they bring in a dude to sell it wholesale or something. Like, again, the intent of this was clearly a compliment. He was trying to compliment these different groups on their strengths, their cultural strengths. And, you know, 20 years ago, that was a compliment. And in 2018, it's not.
Yeah.
But the intent was good. Yeah. I mean, like Shorty, the first person to die in the revolution was this big, peaceful, gentle, giant black man who was up on the rock because he had, you know, committed murder back on Earth. Mm-hmm. He's the nicest, gentlest guy in the world who died saving Wyo. It's not a coincidence that he made that character black. He was clearly saying that it's not just white people who do good things, which back in this book was written was a pretty radical concept.
Yeah. But then Wyo, you know, goes through the whole transformation, like in the old, there was a movie in the 80s called Soul Man, where C. Thomas Howell made himself up to look black to get a minority scholarship.
Like, okay.
That is not a movie that you could do today. So, although it can be done the other way, like the Wayans movies, like White Chicks.
Right? Yeah.
So there's some stuff that'll make you maybe cringe a little bit just with your 21st century view looking back on it. But like you said, when you look at it in the context of when it was written.
Yeah. Well, because one of the things he did, which I was interesting too, is that there were a couple characters that they were introduced as characters, strong leader characters, and then it was referenced later, their race.
Right.
But it was clearly only introduced because that was part of that particular line of the story. It wasn't that it was relevant to the story. Look, we have a multiracial Congress, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's like being totally redundant here, but it was extremely progressive. And I would think that if you were I've never been a woman in 66.
Yeah.
Okay. I've never been a woman in 1966.
Right.
But I would think if I was reading this book, it would be something I wasn't that familiar with, a male writer casting me in this type of role. I think it would have been very empowering. I think. Never walked those shoes, but mm-hmm. seems like it.
Well, Scott, I don't want to keep you too long. Anything else that you're burning to talk about this book?
Yeah, I there's a very good chance I pick it in front of the movie theater when the movie comes out. I say this jokingly because, I mean, some books just don't translate to movies.
No, it's true.
I mean, I'm so sorry to like Ender's Game might have been a decent movie on its own merit.
Yep.
But as a fan of the book, it was heartbreaking because, you know, Ender's Game was about the things that were going on inside Ender's head.
Yes.
That's what the book is about.
Yeah, and you can't translate to
a film. That to a battle didn't work. Now, having said that, Starship Troopers was a brilliantly fun movie that, you know, you didn't need a book to, I mean, the connection between the book and the movie was very broad.
Very tenuous, yeah.
Yeah, but the movie was on its own merit was still awesome. The book was about the philosophy of the military and freedom and human rights and all sorts of other philosophical things that the book had none of. But the book, so I mean, Mooners and Harsh Missions might be a good movie, but I'm going to go into it thinking there had never been a book before.
Yeah, my other podcast, actually, that's all we do is talk about books that are turned into movies.
Okay, yeah.
And so when I mentioned that I had talked to somebody from the Heinlein Society, that was for our Starship Troopers episode. So,
okay, and did you enjoy that movie?
You know, I'm not a big fan of it because I do really enjoy some of the philosophical stuff in the book that just doesn't make it into the movie.
Sure.
And on the other hand, it's just fun, you know.
Well, it's so camp.
Yeah.
So I think what I liked about it was that the difference between that and Ender's Game is that Starship Trooper didn't try to.
Exactly. Like, yes.
They weren't trying to be the book. Where Ender's Game still tried to have some characters and some people in there that was just, you know, they just capitalized on the name.
Yeah, there's more than one way to do a bad adaptation of a movie or a good adaptation of a book, because you can try and hew too faithful to it, and then you're close but not quite there, and nobody's going to like it, or you take too many risks and people are like, well, this is this book a name only, but that's it.
Yeah. So. Well, there's always the idea that they. One of the things we're getting a little off topic here, but it's
okay.
Is that when you take a movie and you try to like hit these bullet points from the book because they were in the book and you force these things into there, it's almost frustrating, you know,
sure.
Whereas if you just kind of just realize it's a different adaptation. I mean, things like Shawshank Redemption and Stand By Me, those were both Stephen King books that were good books, but the movies were insanely good.
Yeah.
And they were on their own merit. They didn't try to touch on every point from the book, which that's why they worked. But that's a whole level of skill that maybe that's harder to come by. So my fingers are crossed on the book. My biggest hope is that if the movie is good, that maybe people will pick up the book because of the movie and then get something out of it.
Yeah. Well, that's usually the best case scenario.
Yeah, that's what we hope. And then we become a libertarian society, and then we all move to Wyoming. I don't know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I liked the bit where Prof was talking about, you know, formulating the government, and he said, yeah, sure, do two houses of your legislature. That way, less legislation will happen, which I thought, it's a little too close to home.
Yeah, but some of that, though, comes from, you know, some of the, what do you call it, Jeffersonian? Did I just make that word up? The Jeffersonian philosophy. Which is whenever the government does anything, they will take away human rights. So let's make it difficult. And then when people say, well, oh, because of the way things are, nothing ever gets passed and no one can ever get anything done. And like that wasn't an accident.
Sure.
There was some ideas that, I mean, Thomas Jefferson, I think he used to say that we need a revolution every 50 years because the government will get out of control. And so I think that some of those things, that was one of my favorite parts of the book was when Prof was suggesting different ways of forming a government. For example, saying that you need 2/3 of the people to agree that a bill should be proposed. You need to have at least 2/3 of the people agree this bill or this law is a good idea, but then it only takes 1/3 of the people to actually veto it, because if you don't have the support of at least 2/3 of the other house, and the whole concept there is that less things will get passed.
Right.
Unless they're really good, or at least people think so, but it's limiting power of government. And but then of course he failed because people wanted to be governed. That's the end of it. So
I think Prof would get along well with Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Well, anything else?
Boy.
I mean, we're never gonna cover everything that you wanted to talk about, I'm sure.
No, I know. No, I think this has been brilliant. I love talking about the book and the philosophy, and you know, I like being able to give. Well, because usually when I start talking about the book, I hit a point of diminishing return where the person I'm talking to about it doesn't want to really hear anymore about it, or don't want to spoil it. So you can't really get too in depth.
Yeah.
But no, I think, you know, just read it. It's brilliant. And again, the audio. I think the audio book in this case is every bit as good as the paper. The old-fashioned version.
Nice.
And it's, by the way, the audiobook is free on about 20 different YouTube channels. And if you find the audiobook that has a commercial break every 2 minutes, go to the next one, because some of them have zero commercials.
Right.
In them.
Well, before we sign off, where can people find you?
Scott Stokely, Facebook page.
Okay.
You'll see the Blue Power. You can message me about email marketing your business. I said there'd be no more plugs, but I'm in sales.
No, I'm giving the opportunity.
So come, if you have any questions about marketing your business, I'd be happy to talk to you about it and what we can do. And the other thing is come check out our Blue Power events, the special needs disc golf. And I like working in the special needs community too. Yeah. And so, but yeah, my Facebook page, you can message me through there.
Cool. Well, I'll make sure to get any links from you if I don't already have them and put those in the show notes so people can find you. So.
Brilliant. Man, this was like one of the most fun things I've ever done. I've done a ton of podcasts talking about Frisbee and some talking about marketing. They've all been fun, but this has been really special because if I can share this with people, I don't know. It's just really cool for me. So I really appreciate the chance.
I really appreciated you coming on. That's awesome. So, before I officially sign off, though, you mentioned your podcast. I want to make sure to get a plug for that in here, too.
Oh, so yeah, every Wednesday night on the Blue Power Facebook page, Blue Power Disc Golf Facebook page, I do a one-hour show called Disc Golf History and Legends.
Oh, nice.
And it's all about the history of disc golf. So the one in two nights is the history of disc golf in Washington.
Oh, cool.
Nice, yeah,
that's in my neck of the woods.
I just did the history of disc golf in Oregon. I was awful. So if you've listened to one, don't listen. Well, this is new to me, and I have three guests on at a time, and that's a skill that I thought would be easy. And
no, it is not.
Not. Well, the first couple just happened. I lucked into them being easy. The guests were fantastic.
Yeah.
I did a very poor job keeping the Oregon one flowing, but I'm confident the one for Washington is going to be much better.
That is why I edit my podcast. So I don't have the stones to do it live.
Yeah, I thought about that, and the video part makes it harder. But then I decided doing it live and letting people chat during that, that was kind of the trade-off. So there's no editing, but the chat during.
That is cool.
So that's the thing.
Well, again, Steve, Steve turned me on to you, but Scott, thank you so much for coming on. It is an absolute pleasure having you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Talk to you down the line. Bye.
All right. Okay.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Scott, and I'm going to include all his links, of course, in the show notes, so make sure to check out his stuff, especially if you're interested in disc golf and you're in Oregon. I'll put a link to his upcoming event in Newburgh, Oregon. And we both, of course, recommend that you pick up the book because it was an interesting one, certainly one that was fun to talk about. As always, I invite you to leave a review for us in whatever platform you listen to us. I'd really appreciate that. And of course, share it with your friends. I have to believe if you're listening to this podcast, you have nerdy friends. So share it with them. I'd very much appreciate that. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.